Hello, this recording is being made by Daphne Young for the Rowlands Castle Historical Society. It's recording number 23-1. The interviewee is Lizzie Gradage, but her husband Michael Gradage is also present and might chip in if required. Hello Lizzie, can you start by telling us where you come from and what brought you to Rowlands Castle?
Hello. We came to Rowlands Castle in 1984. My father-in-law, Michael's father, was a dairy farmer on the Wiltshire-Hampshire border over near Salisbury. And he had two farms. And we couldn't believe it that after all these years, that's where they grew up and had always been. And he always had a dream of being an arable farmer. He used to call it being a barley baron. And he often used to watch the Farmers Weekly property things. And he's always having dreams of buying a big farm. And we never quite believed it when he actually did come and buy Home Farm at Stansted. Stansted estate were selling quite a bit of land at the time. They were selling Lordington, Home Farm, which is our farm, Drew's Farm, and also a farm at the top of Forestside, which is owned by Roger Smith, which the name of at the moment escapes me. They were selling the land because they were going to open Stansted as a charity trust, and selling this land was going to finance it, I suppose. I said we moved from dairy farming to arable and beef. In actual fact, the day of moving, because I was actually pregnant with our first children, which were twins, and the day that they were moving one of the farms to Home Farm, I went into premature labour with the twins. They were 31 weeks, which was 10 and a half weeks early. So they were all down here at Home Farm when I was on the other end, other side of the county on the Hampshire-Wiltshire border going into premature labour. Michael and I, obviously it was all a very successful outcome. We had two beautiful boys who spent the first 4 weeks in hospital, and then they came home just around about the time when their actual due date was. And then we, Michael and I joined the second farm was sold, and Michael and I joined my father-in-law and mother-in-law on the 22nd of March 1984. Which actually happened to be my birthday. And we lived in, initially we had to live in this big farmhouse, Home Farm house, with our in-laws, because the cottages that were sold with the farm had Stansted's tenants still in them. And Stansted, well, at that time, it took quite a while before they found new places for the tenants to go. And then by the September of that year, Michael and I moved into one Home Farm cottage. As I said, we were dairy farmers, but we brought some cattle to the farm, and there was a few beef animals for a while. My father-in-law's big dream was to be arable farming, so they were very much being wound down. And in actual fact, some of the crossbred breeds, in particular the Limousin, which are huge beasts, were not the easiest of animals to look after. They were quite aggressive, and it eventually got to the stage when my father-in-law decided it was just too risky keeping these animals anymore, and we were quite glad to see the back of them. We carried on We had another two children. My second son Matthew, and then we had a daughter Heather, and then when Heather was around about 6 months old, I went back to work. Relief milking, because dairy farming was my first love, and I love dairy cows and I miss them dreadfully. It was also quite a good supplement income because I could do relief milking on all the farms between here and Chichester. At the time, in the 80s, there were 30 dairy farms between here and Chichester. I only worked on a few of them over the years, but now, even earlier than this, because it's now 2023, but in 2007, the last dairy farm shut down between here and Chichester. There are no dairy farms between here and Chichester. The only one that was left on my list of farms that I used to milk on is the farm, Manor Farm at Del Quay. Yeah. So anyway, back to our arrival in Home Farm. It was an arable farm of 308 acres, which in 1984 was a middle-sized farm. By today's standards, it is a tiny farm. It is just not viable as a farm. 308 acres. And a lot of the farms around here have either teamed up or do contracting work in order to keep going. A little bit about the buildings, yeah. The home farm was originally an old farmhouse from the 1700s, which is now what we call our stable block. And a courtyard and buildings around it, but that was the original farmhouse in the 1700s. And then sometime in the Georgian era, Home Farm House was built. And it's quite interesting that they built a very wide front and then a big long L shape going back to the back of the building. And then again, a little while later, they put on an extension onto the back of that. And we had some people come out who understood all about old listed buildings and was able to look at the architecture. And he could tell us that where all the different extensions and redesign had been done. I do remember my father-in-law being most disgruntled when suddenly somebody declared that it was a listed building. Over the years, this has always kind of distressed us because as we found out more about the history of the building and we recognised things, a lot of the features have gone. And now, because it's a listed building the 1980s, it was declared as a listed building, we're not allowed to put back the original features. And we think that they would actually look quite nice because there was bay windows on the side and there was some really beautiful porches compared to what there is now. But sadly, the date was declared and therefore it can only be kept in the condition that when they declared it was a listed building. The other interesting thing about the front of the house is that there are six windows,
five
windows, corrected five windows, and every single one of them is a different style and they have to be preserved as well. Underneath the driveway there are the footprint of a Tudor building, but as Michael pointed out, apart from knowing that it's a Tudor building, we haven't got any maps. We haven't seen any maps which actually record this Tudor building, but originally there was a Tudor building. Right. As time went on, Michael and and his dad were ran the farm. They did the arable farming. And then I can't think when it was, but around sometime around the end of the 80s, in the 90s, we started to repurpose the old original 1700 farm buildings as a DIY horse livery. This was at first a very small thing, but as time went on, it was very much supplementing the income of the farm. But very, very low key while my father-in-law was running it. Oh, and one of the other things I just have remembered, the original records and the deeds for Home Farm and all the properties on Home Farm were lost in the fire at Stansted. That's another reason why we don't know a huge amount about the farm. And another interesting factor was it was originally bought in 1984 for 500,000. 575,000. And it was valued in 2014 at 4.2 million, which is, we think, astounding. Some of the interesting things of life on the farm during the 90s, the children, as they got older, became quite involved with Stansted Estate and the shoot, and they used to enjoy going up there. And at that time, when Stansted had a gamekeeper and they had regular shoots. I have a nice story about our beloved dog. We had a dog from before we had the boys, the twins, and he was devoted and wonderful Labrador cross dog. When my son Paul was in hospital with an eye injury, and Michael was bringing the children in to see us while we were in hospital and going home again. And the dog was very much my dog. And so we thought that the fact that he'd gone missing was because he was a bit distressed because he would have expected me to be around. But as it turned out, tragically, he had been shot by poachers. And it was actually the gamekeeper at Stansted who finally found him. We didn't find him for quite a few weeks. And what had happened was he had been out, in, as he often did, in the backfield, barking because there was somebody there. And they shot him full on in the chest with a shotgun, which broke our hearts. He was 11 years old a great man. We've never had a dog since. Any other family stories? Obviously, the children really enjoyed growing up on Home Farm. We never knew where they were.
Involvement with the village.
Yeah, we.
I remember you doing something amazing in the parish hall.
Yeah.
Where did you stand?
Yes. In that time. It must have been in, was it 1993 or something like that? Early 90s. If you may remember, there used to be a programme on telly called Challenge Annika, and she used to go and get people to do amazing challenges. And we decided to galvanise the village into having a concert for, I can't remember what funds we were raising it for. Was it Children in Need?
Yeah.
Children in Need. That's right. We were raising, we decided. So we went, I went down to the village and I went around knocking on doors and asking people if they would do any acts or whatever. We got a cast of different people who would do different performances. And then we went around and sold tickets at £3 a head, I think, down in the parish hall. And it was actually quite an amazing night.
It was brilliant. It was far more than a concert. There were all sorts of
It was just lovely to see the village all just chip in and enjoy it. Good old fashioned fun. At other times, I became a Christian, although I had been brought up as a Catholic. I was very much a churchgoer rather than an actual Christian in my childhood. And without telling you a very long story, it was very much St. John's Church that was instrumental in my becoming a Christian. And in particular, those people who can remember, Canon Uckwell was one of the first people to have a great impact on me. I was very, very, because of my Catholic church background, I was very, very suspicious of the established church, and you weren't going to get me to cross the door of an established church at the time. But God had different plans for me. And it was from the prayers of the people at St. John's, and then obviously the Holy Spirit completely changed and turned me around. And I can still remember with great affection going into the church reluctantly and then hearing Canon Uckwell's sermon, and it was this, it was just for me. And that led to me being a member of St. John's from the time that, around about 1988, I think, when Heather was born. And then in 2006, we decided to do a Passover on the green, and we also put up a garden tomb and a cross, which we got the timber from Stansted Estate for that. And I can remember the time, it was incredibly heavy wood. And it took 3 or 4 people to carry it. It was just such a heavy piece of timber. We had a wonderful time that first year doing Passover. We put tents up all around the green, a bit like the Israelites would have done on in the days of the wilderness. And we had supper out on the green, and then we had already put up the tomb with it was an artistic impression because you could actually see right through it, and then we put up the cross on Good Friday. Well, the Passover supper was on the Thursday. We put the cross up that night, and then on the Sunday morning, Easter morning, we rolled away the stone at the tomb. The every year following that, still to this year, we have always put the cross back up, and it would be quite often on the Thursday, Maundy Thursday, we would have a service in the church, and then after the service, we would carry the cross from the top of Red Hill Road down to the village green. That was when we were all young, possibly stupid, because it would again take several of the men taking turns carrying the cross down to the green. And then as the time has gone by, as the years have rolled by, the cross has got incredibly light. It's really, really, really quite light. And now myself and Michael can put it up by ourselves.
Oh, wow.
We don't walk it down from the green anymore, but it is. I do think that it is a lovely thing to see every Easter on the green. I hope it'll long may it continue. The other thing, kind of changing direction again now, Michael, back in the mid-90s, did you not find something very interesting on the farm? One of the things that was quite interesting is that my mother-in-law and father-in-law very, very rarely went away. But on this particular week, they'd gone out for a joyride, as they like to call it, together. And I was out with the kids. So Michael was alone on the farm, and he was working in the fields. What were you doing?
I was rolling the corn in
after the field had been ploughed and drilled, and I glanced over my shoulder and saw something sticking out the ground. So I stopped, got out, pulled it up, and it was a mortar bomb, a live one.
And what did you do?
I phoned Havant Police, and they didn't want to know about it. So I phoned Chichester, and they didn't want to know. So in the end, a policeman came out on his motorbike from Salesy and said, "Ooh, it's a bomb." And I said, "Yes, I know it is." So in the end, we got the bomb disposal from
Aldershot,
that's right. And they came, they closed the avenue down and blew it up. And no one was there to see it.
No one was there to see it happen. And then in 2013, my father-in-law died. My mother-in-law had died 10 years earlier, and it had always been my father-in-law's intention that Home Farm would continue as a farm. He was he put up with the horse livery as a necessary evil. He was not interested in diversification. He wanted Home Farm to be Home Farm, a farm down through the generations. In his will, that's how he left it. Michael has three siblings. And he, in his will, he left the farm in trust to his grandson, with Michael and myself having the right to live in it for life, and work it for life. And then he gave money to the other three children, which did mean that we had to raise some funds in order to do it. But what had been ill-advised, and he didn't know and didn't understand, was that when they moved to Home Farm and they sold up their other farms, the solicitors had told them to buy Home Farm as tenants in common. But it was never explained what that meant. It was never made clear that if you are tenants in common, it's not the same as a husband and wife owning a property. If a husband and wife just own a property, then the first spouse who dies, everything gets straight away given to the second spouse. And then that person has to make a will, or else it automatically gets split up between all the inheritance, the children. So unfortunately, my father-in-law had thought that when his wife died, that he now owned the entire farm. And so he wrote his will accordingly. And then it was discovered that, no, that's not the case. And so we ended up in a position where we had to honour the original, the will, and give the money to Michael's siblings, but also to give half of the farm to them as well. So we ended up, sadly, having to sell half the land back to Stansted. It was kind of fortunate that Stansted bought it back and not somebody else. But yes, that was a real blow, because, as I'd said, 308 acres wasn't a viable farm on its own. And we would have originally, had Grandad's plans been able to be carried out, we would have joined with another farmer and done cooperative farming going forward, and we were looking forward to that. But as it was, we had to completely change direction and completely go into diversification. This is when the horse yard became the main business, which was the saving of the farm, really, wasn't it? Because we could still farm in the sense that we were still growing grass and making hay, But the arable side had to be let go. And so now the farm carries on with we rent out buildings to light industry, and our main business is horses and hay sales. And then I think I'm getting towards the end of kind of like the list of things that happened. My other great thing that I love to talk about whenever I talk about farming is what happened to the dairy industry over the time, and how come the 30 dairy farms are all gone, and why is it when you drive around the motorways of England now, you very rarely see any cows in the field. I'm heartbroken by this, but it has been because of the common agricultural policies and the disbanding of the McMarketing Board that the dairy industry has just been wiped down. When we first started in 1984, well, before 1984, but in 1984, we were getting 24 pence per litre for milk off the farm. And that was 1984. By the time we got to 2007, farm and the other thing was the milk quotas as well. That put the final nail in the coffin, because it changed dairy farms from just land to a commodity that people wanted. You had to buy the right to produce milk. And the more you paid to produce milk, the more milk you had to produce. So everything went up in price. And in 2007, farmers weren't getting 10 pence a litre for milk. When you think about the span of years and the rising costs of fuel and feed and everything else, we were getting less than 50%. From the 1984 prices. This is all the time while we were importing cheap, inferior milk from France and exporting our higher quality milk to Europe. There was all sorts of stories of when I was working on relief milking on the local farms, the big tankers would come to pick up the milk. They would drive down from London with a full tank of raw milk to Portsmouth, offload it, fill up with a tank of raw milk and take it back up to London. Why? Why was it doing this? And all the time, every time, they were always saying, ooh, the price of milk has to drop, the price of milk has to drop. All the farmers in this area, and there were some excellent farmers, some with pedigree herds, were being squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. And then with the whole quota system, there were times when I would go to milk the cows, and we'd have something like 5,000 litres of milk in a tank. And the farm had reached its quota. Chichester Dairy couldn't get milk because it didn't have any. But we were not allowed to sell it. You had to pull the plug and it all went down the drain. And then there was the crisis of the environmental crisis. You cannot put that amount of milk down into the drains. So we had to find another way of throwing the milk away. These are all the reasons for the demise of the dairy industry, which used to break my heart. When I was working on one of the smaller farms, I used to just milk in the afternoons. They always did the early morning milkings. So at the weekends, I would do the Saturday and the Sunday afternoon. And sometimes, once a year, they might go away for a week's holiday. And I would actually do a whole week's full of milking. And in 2005 and 2006, I was earning more money than the farmer was. That's how bad the dairy industry had got. So when you go and buy your milk in Tesco's and you pay a really cheap price, you are absolutely screwing over the dairy farmers. It's not, you know, Tesco's aren't taking the cut. It's the dairy farmers who are taking the cut. Tesco's are making their money. And I know people like the local delivery system is very expensive, but that is the kind of price you should be paying for your milk. But unfortunately, even the delivery, milk and more delivery, the money's still not going to the farmers. Right, there's my sadness. I don't have anything else I can think of to add about farming.
Okay, anything else, or shall we call it a day?
I think we can call it a day. What do you think?
Thank you.